urban farming is amazingly unsustainable and has a huge hold on the world. But as many subsistence farmers in the northern rainforest region of Honduras are discovering, lives, landscapes, and futures can and are changing. Mike Hans with the Inga Ali Project is sharing how this works. Then we'll hear from Jim Hayes and his daughter, Shannon Hayes. Their home on Sapbush Hollow Farm in upstate New York is a truly sustainable operation, a literal living proof of how the generations learn from each other and profit too. This is Robin with Cultivated Audio, the Regenerative Agriculture Conversations. Let's dig in. Mike, we mostly hear about slashing and burning going on in the Amazon by the dastardly loggers and ranchers, but the subsistence family farmers throughout the world have been using this practice for generations, and looking at a map, it's going on a huge amount of land, isn't it?
It is. There's been a sort of post-colonial myth saying indigenous farmers have slashed and burned for centuries, which is true. It's the one way you could convert living or formerly living vegetation into minerals and put it in the soil. And that it's sustainable and in harmony. It absolutely is not sustainable, and it is not in harmony. And I'm not saying this out of the sense of blaming anybody for what they do.
No.
I've done the soil science. I've been working on it for 35 years. It is not sustainable. People had no alternative. Most of agricultural Europe was forest and was cleared by slash and burn in the Neolithic, 5,000-6,000 or more years ago. That's how they did it. But the difference between that and the acid soils of the humid tropics could hardly be more than sort of poles apart. You have on the one hand the most productive ecosystem on the planet, the rainforest, achieving that productivity on some of the poorest, most weathered, leached acid soils on the planet. And that was a sort of key question that kept coming to the fore in my mind in the mid-1980s when I was beginning to address this problem. I'd seen it at first hand in West Africa and the lowlands of Ethiopia. I saw it at first hand in Central America when I was doing hydrography on the big rivers in Honduras. And I just thought that the planet cannot sustain this consumptive destruction of forest, because in the end, you'll have an imaginary hill in which slash and burn farmers start at the bottom, they meet at the top, and there's the last tree. Well, what are they going to do?
Right.
You know, they come up from all sides. What happens then? When it first began, particularly in the sort of subhumid tropics, the water tables rise and fall in subhumid tropics. And I think the destruction of soil, both in structure and in chemistry, was much slower. I think it's happening. I see it all over West Africa. But in rainforests, every time the vegetation is consumed by fire and converted into ash, you get a very temporary benefit, a change of soil pH. In other words, a slight amelioration of the acidity of the soil. But you get massive leaching. And that is the primary reason why it is absolutely not sustainable. And I definitely don't say that from a moral standpoint. I say it from a scientific standpoint, and also concern for what we're seeing now in Honduras. For example, what came out of the seven-year trials in Cambridge studies in Costa Rica, we slashed and burned with the University of Costa Rica 2 hectares of secondary rainforest. It was about 25, 30 years old. And we conducted conventional agriculture on that resulting site together with six agroforestry systems with and without supplements. 7 years of continual trial, deliberately very hard trial, because we were cropping maize and beans at 6-month intervals remorselessly, you know, running down the fertility of the soil and then testing for response. The only system that came through was alley cropping with Inga, not alley cropping with anything else. All the species of Inga we tried came through beautifully. 4 of them were, out of the 8 were just outstanding. And the other caveat was any sustainable system in these soils needs rock phosphate. not fertilizer phosphate, which is soluble. It needs rock phosphate, which lingers in the soil. When we brought that system to Honduras, we tested it with real people, with NGO collaborators who selected and identified the families. And we tested small areas, 10th of a hectare, so we weren't putting the families' livelihood too much at risk. But they were involved from the very beginning. That was to just see whether a system developed by an academic and also a gringo in their eyes was anywhere near acceptable to them. And the answer that came back was, we love it. And particularly, we love the vast amount of firewood that it produces every time we do the annual pruning. We just recommend in Honduras one pruning a year only, and you let the trees and the soil recover. Now, when we really began to roll this out in the Cangrejal Valley, particularly, we encountered a number of plots where the Inga was struggling, even though we'd applied rock phosphate. And one in particular, the Inga was about 10 months old and was really miserable looking, about a meter and a half tall, and chlorotic, yellow. And clearly, I mean, failing. Abrahma, our chief, was really, he thought we're going to lose it. And I then said, well, okay, well, try what I tried in the Cambridge experiment, which didn't produce a response. Put on some mineral supplement, dolomitic lime for the magnesium, and K-Mag, which is an available form in balance of potassium magnesium sulfate. The result was astounding. It was out there 2.5 months later. And those trees had gone from 1.25 meters to sort of 3 meters, 4 meters in 2.5 months. We then go back to the farmer and we said, when was this rainforest? Was it your dad or your grandfather who first came and slashed and burned? And when was that? How many years ago? He said, no, hombre, no. It was my great, I think it was two greats and maybe a third grandfather that came with an axe and a machete maybe 120 years ago and started carving out what he thought was his future livelihood. And over that period of time, the soil has had probably easily 20 slash and burn episodes. And every single one of the farmers with this kind of soil is saying to us, it's sterile. They use the word esteril. It won't produce anything. In some cases, not even invasive grass. What we now do is when we plant the Inga from the nursery, foot tall or something like that, we spread a mixture now, a cocktail of rock phosphate, dolomitic lime and K-Mag, which the guys now call La Mezcla Magica. It's a magic mixture. And the great thing is, when you do that, the trees soak it up. And you can also plant a crop of beans, which will benefit as well, won't compete with the Inga, which are also legumes. And the trees grow rapidly and very healthily. So what I'm saying here is we're looking at soil that's been degraded over a century. And this is the only system we know, the combination of trees and this mineral supplements, that is capable of restoring them.
My first question from hearing you speak about the development here is, why do you think the Inga was the tree that really made a difference? And then maybe you can flow into what that project entails and what an Inga alley actually looks like with the different plants.
Okay. I'll start with what it looks like. What emerged, the only sort of approach that offered any promise of sustainability in this soil environment, was really mulching systems where you're bringing in green material, spreading it as green organic fertilizer on the soil, and it's decomposing, it's also protecting the soil. Alley cropping was conceived actually in West Africa. As far as we know, it might have been used by the late Maya. We don't know yet. However, in recent times, it was developed in a research center in Nigeria. They said, right, instead of bringing in material from outside, you grow it somewhere and you mulch it on the soil, grow it in situ and control it. And that's led to one approach that advocates the use of cover crops like mucuna, calabari. These are legumes that cover the soil and then you're supposed to slash them and plant. You can't propose and promote a system in which people have got to go out and buy industrially produced nitrogen fertilizers. As it happens, the experimenters in Nigeria use Central American legume shrubs, Lucaena, Caliandra, Gliricidia, Cespania. These are all Central American legumes. And these are legume species with tiny little leaves like acacias, so they will decompose quickly again. When I actually investigated how the rainforest was functioning and actually got into La Selva in northern Costa Rica and dug a few little holes, looking at the root distribution, you've got a huge stature forest, some of the trees up to 60, 70 meters. And the entire root system is feeding in about a little more than 10 centimeters of soil. Wow. Right up in the surface, which is where the decomposition is taking place, where all the litter from the canopy is coming down, the frass from insects, the dieback of roots. It's all concentrated in this very, very thin zone. And the reason it can be concentrated there is because it's protected. The sun never gets to it. So it doesn't desiccate, it doesn't overheat. And so the roots can explore in a protected environment. That's the lesson the forest taught me. Inga is a huge genus for a start, over 350 species of Inga. They're neotropical legume trees. They're pioneers species in general that fill gaps in rainforest. How they achieve 350 species in the space of probably 5 million years blows my mind. One thing that we're finding with particularly the species we're using is they're very tolerant of very acid, otherwise very difficult soil. They seem to have some incredible tolerance. But the other absolutely invaluable feature is that the leaves are relatively big and tough, and they do not decompose quickly. If you do a pruning, first pruning of an Inga plot, and plant things, the maize or the beans is not going to get much benefit from the present pruning. But what you have done is created conditions that are very similar to those of the rainforest, so that the recovering trees, but also the maize and the beans, can concentrate their roots right up in the surface. I took some root corings in one of our Inga alleyways, and what I found was 31% of the fine roots, those are the roots doing the actual work, were concentrated in the top 2 centimeters of soil. 2 centimeters, you know, less than an inch. 29% were actually in the underside of the mulch itself. That is, in the decomposing litter that was there from the previous prunings and probably from the one before that and so on. And the rest, 40%, were concentrated in down to about 10 centimeters, and that was it. There's nothing below about 10 centimeters. Now, that system was responding to the same thing that makes the rainforest so successful and has done for, I suppose you could say, a couple of 100 million years. I went to a famous research institution in Costa Rica when I was there in the pilot study. I won't name it. Those who know Costa Rica will know it. And they had had an Inga project, $1 million spent on studying Inga. And the reason is Inga was, in the old system in the highlands, commonly used as shade over coffee, and many species, at least half a dozen. When I went to the research institute to see what they were saying, I spoke to the director. And he said, "Oh, no, Inga, no, stupid tree. We grow it and then we send the guys out to do the pruning and the tree dies. Stupid tree, don't use Inga." So I don't know how many stupid trees you've ever met, but I've never met one in the whole of my life. But I knew what I'd seen in the coffee plantations and also in the lowlands as shade over cacao. I loved the deep litter that was formed under the Inga. I could see the roots of the coffee doing exactly what the roots of the rainforest does, because these were former rainforest soils, right up under the protection of the mulch. So if you imagine in the Inga Alley system, you've got hedgerows of Inga tightly planted together, only 50 centimeters apart in the rows, and the rows are 4 meters apart. Between the rows, you have the alley. That's where the cropping takes place. Once they grow to full canopy, which in a healthy soil is probably done within about 16 months, say 20 to 24 months, is completely shaded over. So they've killed off all the grasses and the weeds that would otherwise compete with the crop. Then you prune, you strip the foliage from the branches, and you take the branches off for domestic firewood, which the families love because it doesn't produce much smoke. And once it's dry, it's a very quick, clean burn. Like aspen, you make matches
right
out of aspen because it's a clean, quick burn. And that's why they like it. It's like turning up the gas. And everybody in this environment cooks on these clay stoves, hot plates and ovens. On the soil, you've got probably anything like between 6 and 8 inches of deep green mulch, which will then settle a little bit. And what they used to do was use a planting stick, put 2 or 3 grains of maize or beans under the mulch bag, and that's how they plant it. What they do now is so that they're working in the shade, which is beautiful and cool. They plant the seeds. Immediately they then mulch, do the pruning, take off all the branches and stems, and you've got the soil protected under 6 or maybe 8 inches of deep green mulch, and then the seed can germinate in complete protection beneath that. Once it's germinated and developing, it has the strength in the seed to push right through the mulch, and then once it's through, it's got a complete monopoly of light, nutrients, moisture, and the trees have been cut back to sort of like fence posts, so there's no shade anymore. And weed seeds, by definition, produced by the millions, and they're tiny, they can germinate as much as they like, but they cannot push through. So the crop develops under a mulch that starts at about 6 to 8 inches and then probably shrinks down to maybe 4 or 5 inches, something like that. And it's decomposing material. And it just provides physical protection, moisture retention, cool conditions. The sun can never overheat the soil, so the roots can explore where they want, which is right in the surface, as they did in the forest.
Incredible.
That's why Inga is so useful.
Now, can you share some about the watershed improvements you've seen and experienced?
Yeah.
I believe I saw a picture on one of your sites about some beans that had grown where there had literally been no rain at all.
Yeah, amazing. That's right. And we always have known that the family that has an Inga alley system within 2 or 3 years has really begun to restore the soil organic matter the soil once had, and has completely disappeared as a result of repeated slashing and burning, partly due to the sort of slight liming effect you get with ash, but also a wetting and drying of the soil and superheating under exposed soil under the tropical sun superheats. And all of that leads to the loss by decomposition of soil organic matter. So the Inga system is building it back. And we knew that, and we knew it would also retain moisture, but I never would have imagined that we would see what we did in either 2016 or 2019. The 2019 story was that we were in an El Nino event. Nobody really knew what the weather would do, but a lot of the guys with Inga alleys decided to prune and plant in February, which is a bit unusual in that part of the world. Normally they'd be doing it in May, June, and again in December, but they did it in February. There'd been a few light showers of rain, and they thought, well, the rain's going to kick in now. In fact, a lot of the conventional slash-and-burn farmers did the same. And the guy you saw on the website, Pablo Pinto is his name, he had been running an Inga alley cropping system for about 4 years, 5 years. And what he did was sowed them in the shade, then did the pruning. And as it happened, the very light showers that had just taken place turned out to be the last for, I think, between 6 and 7 months, which is totally unheard of in Central America. No, it's not even in history has it ever been recorded as a drought that lasted that long, you know, super hot temperature. He did the pruning and the beans came through and not a drop of rain fell. The beans had enough moisture retained under the mulch to produce a complete crop. And not only beans, in his case, they're 50-day beans. It's a variety called Cinquantenio. But also other families have planted maize, which needs at least 2.5 months. And we would never have claimed that you could do that before we saw it with our own eyes and heard the testimony. And they were the only farmers in the region, I think, to take any kind of crop during that time. And then the drought intensified and continued. I thought we were actually going to lose maybe 250,000 Inga. And they defoliated, I think, about 4 months in. But one effect was they put even more mulch and litter on the soil, and the sun simply could not penetrate and overheat. And then when it finally started raining in the September, the trees recovered completely. We hardly lost a single tree. And then by the December, the families had been so freaked out by that experience that they were ready to prune and plant in the December. And they did so. And they all took crops from those same plots that looked as though they were going to die. To me, it's astonishing. I would not have predicted that the Inga could survive that. A lot of farmers, almost all of them now, we've been beginning to get testimony of people saying, La Quebrada comenzó, the little creek that was dry most of the year for most of them, started flowing underneath the Inga plots. And then others were saying springs have started up where there was just maybe from time to time just damp ground. We found the same on our demonstration farm. We've got springs on there that where there was nothing. Again, this is now such a universal story. It's due to the sponge effect of soil organic matter accumulating in the soil. Also, the soil is physically protected from very, very hard rainfall. So the erosive power of violent rainstorms, it's absorbed by the mulch. And by the time the water gets to the soil, it's just trickling in and infiltrating. And then it's held. As one guy earlier this year was asked by Luis, he said, look, from the experience of the last few years, are you going to prune your Inga alley, I think back in February? And he said, no, I'm not going to. I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I would certainly want to plant some more Inga. But why not? He said, I've got three springs that started of pure, sweet water, and I don't want to risk it. What he doesn't understand is actually pruning will absolutely not jeopardize those springs because it's the organic matter.
Right.
It's the organic matter in the soil that's holding it and releasing it slowly. But also, the soil is never desiccating or overheating or cracking because the sun just can't get to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's protected. The top of the mulch is as dry as a biscuit and simply reflects the solar radiation straight back up into space. And the other thing that came from this is, Luis, our agronomist, said, I really love it. I go up into the Inga, which had once been a desperate, desiccated hillside. Now it's a little forest. He said, I lie on my, very often I fall asleep. But when I wake, he said, I can hear the birds up in the canopy. They're full of life.
Certainly.
And he said, he doesn't want to lose. This is astonishing. This is people on the very edge of survival who are making these almost poetic judgments. But no, I don't want to prove it.
Right.
Honestly, well, it's okay if you prune it, really. But, I mean, he's going to have to be convinced because he's pruned for several episodes in the past. But I'll have a gentle, gentle go and say, look, you're not going to lose it. Don't worry. Or just as an experiment.
Yes, maybe half and half or something.
Yeah, prune a half. Just see how it works out. I don't think you're going to lose your spring.
That's it. When the water starts coming back, you know it's working and you know you're doing the right thing. That's just the magic.
Yeah, and it's sort of recent because we knew it. It had to improve soil organic matter. We knew that it improved soil moisture, but really wouldn't have predicted quite this much.
Well, also the day-to-day for the farmers who use this model have more time on their hands, don't they? It's just really changed their lifestyle. And what other social benefits have you seen for these farmers?
Oh, stories are phenomenal. I mean, people often say, oh, well, you know, your system is improving yields. I do actually have to say it's doing a lot more than that, that people are saying this soil was sterile. It's not a question of improving yields. It's a question of you get a crop or you don't get a crop. That's kind of binary. It's not just an improvement of yield. Do you eat or not? That's one story. And the food security is, of course, the number one. The principal thing we promote and extend with them, and we give them the materials to establish, is alley cropping for basic grains, because food security, without that, you can't really do anything else. They have to have food security. Alley cropping Inga for basic grains is just one of a four-component model that we're extending. And none of the others will be possible without the success of the Inga basic grain system. The other three models are comprised of the following. There's Inga alley cropping, exactly like for basic grains, only managed slightly differently, probably different pruning times for cash crops. So pepper is one of the best examples. We have great examples of it on the farm. It's a bit slow to be getting out there at the moment because people are concentrating on doubling and in many cases now tripling their Inga alleys for basic grains. The third component is very different. It's not alley cropping at all. With alley cropping, we're putting in 5,000 Inga per hectare, which is serious planting. This is different. This is like orchards. This is Inga associated with fruit trees. And the best example is cacao. As you know, it's an understory wanting shade, partial shade. But also you can combine Inga with rambutan, avocado, citrus. That's probably a 50-50 combination. And the Inga is the only source of natural nitrogen for the tree crop. And the final component is Inga used as a pioneer species for reforestation with valuable hardwoods. On average, the families have got about, we're told it's about 8 hectares. I think probably the average is actually a bit lower, around 6 maybe. But what they will be doing at present is slashing and burning, or trying to, probably a hectare and a half every year, maybe more, just for the basic grain. And they're desperate. They're having to buy in nitrogen fertilizers. They don't always work. It's a desperate struggle to stop the grasses just swamping the maize or the beans. And in many cases, the soil is so sterile, they can't use it for anything. That's all they have. They've inherited the land, but the land has got a land use history of a degrading process. As things stand at the present, there's no reversal of that. So once you've got the basic grains, you've got food security, then you can say, okay, you can take the rest of the land out of this slash and burn cycle, and you can plant it with agroforest, however you conceive that. If a family had all four components, and it's actually, life is a lot more ragged than the simple explanation I'm giving you. But if you stood back from their holding, you'd say, that's a rainforest. Well, it isn't. It's agroforest. And it's doing everything that forest does for wildlife, for habitat, soil moisture, erosion protection, etc. It's providing a beautiful, shady, cool, protected environment for people to work in. And it's providing an income. It's reviving the rural economy. What the women love mainly is the casual work in the nurseries. We're always filling tens of thousands of soil bags for the trees, or in going in soil beds or things like that. And they love the fact that they can come in early morning when the kids have gone to school.
Right.
Because they're in school around 6.
Yes.
And the ladies can finish around the middle of the day, 1 o'clock, when the kids come home.
Right. So
and
perfect.
We're really happy. We, you know, they want to put in 3 hours in the morning. That's fine. You
yes.
want to put in 8 hours. That's fine too. You know, and they tend to be the women. We don't decree it, but it does work and it's very harmonious. So those are the stories we're now getting. But what's actually happening, the story isn't over, but what we're finding is they love to have rambutans and cacao. We've distributed, I think it's about 400,000 hybrid or grafted top quality Trinitario cacao. So they've got all that. But what they very much seem to be concentrating on is just doubling and tripling. And now the kids are coming along wanting to do the same. Mm-hmm. So the next generation is begging land off mum and dad. And then they're doing the same thing. And to take it further, we've got one in one community of about 50 families in the subcatchment that's completely degraded. I mean, it's heartbreaking to look at it. When we started 12 years ago, I think it was 18 out of the 50 finally signed up, having seen the system working in the demo farm. And some were just sort of reluctant and skeptical. They'd wait on the sideline. And one or two were positively in contrary. You know, they were against it. You let the gringos plant trees on your land, they'll come and claim your land, was the story. So what's happening now is I think we've got all 50, if it is 50. I think that the entire community, little by little, they come trickling in. Can I have the system, including the people who are right against
it? Right.
In the beginning. So it's taken that long, but they trust the team and they trust the project. And they've seen the results in these desperate drought conditions. They've seen people take crops. They've seen people taking a crop without spending a single day controlling the weeds, which is unheard of.
Right. Yes.
And among that community, I'm told, is there are a dozen guys, one slightly older guy, and 11 young guys, you'd say, every one of whom had said they were desperate. They saw no future for themselves except to go to the United States as Mojados, you know, in the caravanes.
Right.
Trump built a wall or started to keep them out, and not realizing what was driving it, but or not caring to know what was driving. But it's failed. 12 of the guys said, when I saw the neighbors with a system that's working, I saw a future and I changed my mind.
That's a beautiful
who
story.
Who would have been trekking up through Guatemala, Mexico,
right,
to the border.
You've also, I've noticed, started considering the Congo and Madagascar. So I'm thinking then that there are trees like the Linga tree that grows worldwide that is actually a nitrogen-fixing tree and could be appropriated for other projects around the world.
Yeah. Well, the system is being replicated now in 15 humid tropical countries, including the ones you mentioned. The thing in Congo was an initiative from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. My great collaborator in this was Terry Pennington, who's an associate of Kew. He wrote the monograph on Inga, all the 350 species. So Kew knew about it, and they got involved in a project in the Republic of Congo, the ex-French colony. And we've been looking at possibilities for sub-Saharan Africa, for wet Africa, for some time. And the guy running it, Martin Cheese, he's very much an Africa forest man. And he was quite convinced that there would be legumes in the African realm in the rainforest that would do there what Inga is doing for us in Central America. Because we were trying to be good little ecologists and responsible and not propose introducing exotics. Like
right,
Inga.
Yes.
In this particular project, we looked at candidate species, spent a lot of time in the herbarium, but also looking at what was there in Congo. And I think we've got 6 under trial, maybe 8 species. They can pretty well all be adapted to do benefit anyway. 2 of them are looking pretty good. As it happens, Inga has been brought by well-meaning people to West Africa, probably by missionaries. I think I think they're in Zaire, they're certainly in Cameroon. Someone introduced them to Cameroon, and then seed from there went to Sierra Leone. I know that recently, the last 12 months, 2 years. There's some in Uganda, there's some in a few other places anyway. The thing in Madagascar, I spent again a lot because desperate deforestation there. There's a tiny project that we put funds in when we can. There's one donor who specifies that some of the funds go to the Madagascar project. And it is a tiny one, but it's actually not Inga, it's an exotic. It's Acacia mangium, which is actually from Australia, and actually is wind distributed. It's a real invasive species. It's a tough species. The families don't like it for firewood. They say it just fills the kitchen with smoke and won't burn properly. But it's all they have in Madagascar, so they're using it. I gather there's one species, one Inga, somebody brought in, I don't know who and when, long time ago, that has been misidentified. I'm certain of it. And that's Kew, actually. And there is a strong case for a controlled trial to see whether Inga would become a problem. But the truth is, while we're exercising our good little ecologist consciences, the situation for people and for the environment, conservation, Madagascar is utterly desperate. Now, I'd say there's a strong justification for an introduction, but a controlled trial under the supervision of and full knowledge of the government. Well, there's a case for that.
Yes. You just said something about if Trump knew why people were coming up, if they spent more money, perhaps helping everyone to really get regrounded, literally, in their soil and in their farming. Think if Madagascar just really took some money and time and focus to do the same, I think the results could be equally successful. But in the recent past, there hasn't been that focus. Mike, I'm going to guess, I don't know if this is true, obviously, if you were first a farmer in Cornwall, England, but have you had any aha moments where farming in one area, like in England, has fed or made better the project in Honduras or in other parts of the world?
The answer is no, but I was very much into as I think you were, how to grow things organically. The absolute sort of seminal thing for me was Grow Your Own Fruit and Vegetables by Lawrence Hills. This was part of the organic movement that grew up pre and post-war. He set himself an incredible target, really. He was very much into the things you've been into, quality of food, nutrition, the vitamin content of food, and how to produce food without poisoning the soil. And the task he set himself was this. He said, I'm going to take the average semi-detached garden in the street in the average town in UK. And I think he said that's like a 30 by 10 meter plot. What could a family do to produce good quality fruit and veg year round? And of course, rotation is absolutely essential if you're going to do it that intensive. You can't grow the same thing on the same soil. You rotate. Some mineral supplements are required. It's not against putting on lime and stuff like that, but very much compost. And he absolutely gripped my imagination. Mm. And I was working, early part of my working life, I spent a few years sort of bohemian way, different things in the world, quite a lot of time at sea on trawlers and also later in, actually on research vessels, which was a lot more interesting and rewarding. But I became a surveyor, a topographic surveyor, and before very long was into development projects in developing countries in the world. And it was there that I was seeing slash and burn just transform entire landscapes, including, I mean, most dramatically for me, Central America, where entire ranges that was covered in rainforest in the time of the Maya, pre-Maya, just covered in invasive grass.
Right.
And it's not logging that's done it. The aim of logging is not to destroy rainforest. Why would you? It's such an expensive waste of fuel. What the aim of logging is to go in and take out valuable timber, mahoganies, rosewoods, other valuable tropical hardwoods. It leaves a hell of a mess, and I don't justify it and I don't defend it. But the aim of logging is not to destroy rainforest. What destroys rainforest is what comes afterwards.
Right.
It's desperate people who know no other way of converting the temporary fertility of soil into crops. It's not a system of agriculture. People talk about slash and burn as a system. It is not. It's a process. And like all processes, it has an end point. There's a starting point, rainforest, and it has an end point, invasive grass. That's what we're seeing right across the humid tropical zone of Central America.
Right.
So I began to feel that sense of discontent, restlessness, both mentally and spiritually around, I guess, in the 70s. It grew. And by that time, I was a freelancer. I was going on some quite lucrative contracts in Africa, Ethiopia, for example. And then also in Central America, as I mentioned, doing hydrography. I was horrified by the scale of it and the result of it, dismayed at the thought that human ingenuity and science couldn't even explain it properly, still less come up with a sustainable solution. And that coincided with the dawning realization that I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. I was good at it, but I was more interested in the environments I was working in and what was going on, and an increasing sense of my own ignorance. I couldn't explain what I was seeing, and that was the point where I changed, went back to school and found myself in Cambridge undertaking a research degree.
Bravo.
Really, a very intensive year, literally retraining myself in tropical ecology, geomorphology, etc. And then got into the research of what I was really got under my skin by that time. What is going on in slash and burn? What are the possible ways out? The project is growing. There's a huge trust now built up by the population. We're inundated with demand from families. And at the moment, Abraham was telling me that there's a huge crop of Inga seed just come in.
Nice.
For once, the parrots left it alone. We can't quite understand that because normally they just rip it to bits. But this time they didn't. And we've got a beautiful crop. So there's tens of thousands,
oh
if
my
not
goodness.
Hundreds of thousands of Inga
Wow.
Going into nurseries. I'd also previously raised plants are now going into the ground. It's a process they call trasando, which is finding the contour, which they do with an A-frame, and planting the trees along it. And that's going on at an enormous pace. Cool. It's enormously rewarding to hear this and then
absolutely,
to see it.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's transforming people's lives.
So, Jim, tell us about the Sapbush Hollow land, the acreage, numbers, and types of livestock that you have today.
Okay. The farm itself is just under 300 acres, but of that, most of it is mountainous, steeped in timber. We have approximately 80 acres, all right, that we are grazing right now. We don't do any hay. We just graze. And the livestock which we have as far as grazing is predominantly sheep. We own cattle, but they're on another farm for various reasons. But we run anywhere from 60 to 100 ewes. We have a few sows, and we breed every year, and we usually finish off about 30 hogs, which we graze those also. And then we do about 1,500 broilers every year, and between 1,500 and 2,000. And some laying hens, a couple of geese, and about 60 turkeys for the holiday. Right? But that's the livestock. Everything gets out on grass. So
you mentioned various reasons why you have the cattle elsewhere. What are those reasons?
Well, we used to bring the cattle in. We brought in stalkers. And our perimeter fences are pretty bad. the problem with cattle is compared to sheep. Let me give you an example. If 200 sheep get out, all right, in a wooded area, you only have to find one, all right, because they flock. And cattle the cattle are dispersed. And I have somebody I used to work with does a very good job grazing. So we've kept with the sheep, and we buy the cattle and then graze them there. It would be a lot easier if we had brood cows, but they take up a lot of extra space and effort, and it's easier for us at this time to do it this way. And the sheep are more profitable because we have more options with them as far as marketing.
Jim, you bought the farm in 1979, I've read, and you began restoring the pastures by grazing sheep. Why were sheep your first choice?
I don't know. It started when I was 3 years old.
Okay, so it was already going on then.
Yes, it was going on. I was obsessed with raising sheep. I like sheep. My son has an obsession for fish, and he works for the National Marine Fisheries now. So I find that sheep have got a lot of advantages as far as efficiency, and they produce wool and meat, and they're nice to work with.
All right, yeah.
But they do have their disadvantages, so.
Okay, well, share one or two of those.
Disadvantage would be the fencing, all right, with respect to, you know, if you had cattle, if you had good perimeter fence, you can break it down very easily. We have to use netting, all right, for the sheep. And then people have a problem with getting the sheep shorn. Some people have gone to hair sheep as a result of it. I used to shear a long time ago, all right, and kept me in college. But now we have someone comes in from New Hampshire, and she does a wonderful job, and she shears them in a day and a day and a half. Plus, a number of people don't have a background in sheep. The transition has been from dairy to beef cattle in our area, and it's an easier jump for them. We've been in the business for a long time, and sheep to us are very profitable.
Wonderful. As an animal science professor, you did a lot of experimenting, seeking out good techniques for finishing livestock on grass. After adding sheep, what steps were taken once you started really looking into and specializing in grass finished?
The farm history. The farm hadn't been really used when we bought it for quite a while. A local neighbor was taking hay off of it, but that's all. The fields were relatively small, and nothing had been done to them for probably 20 or 30 years, other than a mining of hay crop. We went and we soil tested, just like, you know, everybody else does, and we had our biggest problem was pH, and we added lime. And that was the first thing we did. And we did a little fertilizer, but that was 40 years ago, and we haven't used that since. The government was willing to pay us to take out all our fence lines and our stone walls and everything else, but we felt that they were part of the farm and part of the habitat for the wildlife and shade and everything else, so we left them all in. And that's how we got started. And we did put up fence that could keep the sheep in, and various attempts at everything. And we got the property pretty much fenced, and then we started grazing. And what we've continued on with is we just keep on breaking the fields down smaller and smaller with temporary fencing because we're getting higher and higher production. And we just move the sheep just about every day or every other day.
So are they all basically the same size fields?
No. No, they will vary from day to day. And as I said, a lot of our fields are fairly small. Some of them are an acre. Some of them are 7 or 8 acres, and one's 15 acres. And we just break this down, usually to about an acre or less, all right, depending on how many sheep are there and what type of forage is available for them.
Do you find them wanting to graze in different areas at different times of the year?
No. Basically, they graze where I put them, and and they do a good job of it.
Oh, good.
Obedient. We don't give them an option, you know, especially when they're only in there for a day.
Right.
And they graze down, and it's just how much we graze. The first time through, many people might be upset on how much grass we trod. They knock down and trample. But as Jim Goresh says, there is no such thing as wasted grass in that way. We basically, if you want to finish, all right, you've got to get them to eat as much high-quality nutrients as possible. And sometimes the fields we go into are a little bit more mature than we would like, and as a result, we only harvest maybe 20% of it, and we'll let them trample it down, and then we move them on.
Now, you have so many chickens. What is the basic gist with how they live their day-to-day as far as moving?
Well, they're moved every day also. They're in a sort of a hut similar to a Salatin-type chicken tractor. That's where they stay the night, and then they're let out, and then their hut is moved, and they get to graze. But the chickens are not ruminants. They do graze some. The broilers probably graze the least, and the laying hens graze more, and the turkeys graze quite a bit. Basically, we will fence in an area with a couple rolls of netting, and we have a group which usually takes maybe 2 to 3 huts, and we put the chickens in there. They stay in there at night, and they're let out during the day, and when they're out, we move the huts to clean grass, and we keep moving until we're done with that fenced area, and then we fence in another area. And they have water in that area. In fact, one thing about the farm is we've been very fortunate, and other than a new acquisition of land, we have gravity-fed water to every paddock, every field on the farm. That was one of our initial investments.
You talk about crediting selective breeding as the reason for the success not only of your farm, but also the taste of your meats once they're processed. What is involved with your selective breeding process?
The first thing is they don't give me any problems.
They know better.
They know better, yeah. The sheep that gets out isn't one that stays. But we believe the pastures give them a unique flavor. We don't have monoculture whatsoever. We have a wide variety of grasses that we use. And the fact that they have fresh grass every day during the grazing season, I think adds quite a bit to the flavor of the animal, plus the exercise and the air and the whole package. Now, as far as the genetics, we use the chickens. There aren't many options. We use the standard Cornish cross. But our sheep, we do select them so that they do well on our grass situation. And we've done this over years. The basic genetics, I think, of the sheep you would find is a Dorset Texel cross. And we've used this Texels, especially in the Dorset, because they're earlier finishing. And they will come to market weight or market finish within the grazing season.
All right. Are there any mistakes that you see young farmers making that are working sustainably and regeneratively that you've been there and done that you could share?
Don't buy equipment if you can avoid it. This is a rat hole that many people go down, and it's very difficult. And the land purchase, you can get into a lot of trouble with purchasing land. We have done a lot of leases over the years. This works well. People should look at that before they go into serious debt for land. But the equipment usually is the biggest thing. Where the investment should be is in the livestock themselves, fencing, and a good water system. That's probably the best.
Is there something more you could say about the gravity water system that you have?
Yeah, we are cursed and blessed in that we have a lot of hills. And fortunately, we were able to build ponds or a spring development on top of these hills. And the water all flows downhill. And it's great. Every field has a hose in it and multiple places where we can attach. So that enables us to break the fields up as small as we want.
Right.
And then they can have water in every pasture, every paddock.
Yes. Now, you've been at this for quite some time. Is moving the livestock as often as you do new knowledge, or is that something that just instinctively took place now for a long time?
No, it's taken place, but it's a reward system. I mean, how easy it is to move them? Usually quite easy. They know. In fact, they'll let you know if you haven't moved them when they're supposed to be moved. Usually it's a matter of opening the gate and calling them. They know they're going to go to better feed, and they run through. It's a very easy situation to get them broken into. The only problem we have is in the beginning when we turn the lambs and ewes out. The lambs are fairly small. Sometimes they have a little bit of a problem following their mothers, but usually that only lasts for a few days, and then they get with the program. And we have a good dog behind them to move them along if they do have doubts.
Right. Now, how many people are working daily on the farm?
Well, we have a number of people who are involved with the farm. I'm probably the biggest number of hours per week, but we have granddaughters, our two granddaughters, their friend, and another person, and Shannon, and Bob, and my wife. We're all involved, but it's not full-time. It's a full-time job, but we break it up, so everybody's got a little bit.
Yes, it's quite a fortunate situation you have going on there.
And yeah, it was our goal. It was our goal.
Beautiful. And then part of my usual survey, what is your favorite grass-fed steak cut?
Steak cut?
Yes.
All right, beef. Okay, it's the ribeye steak.
All right. And any other suggestions or something you feel like, oh, she didn't ask me about this and this is important?
Well, I've seen a lot of people try to graze, and the big issue is that they don't have enough grass for the animals. And in order to get an animal finished and grazed, you have to have ample amount of grass for them. And remember, they're ruminants, cows or sheep or goats. They only work 8 hours a day. They spend roughly 8 hours eating, 8 hours sleeping, and 8 hours ruminating. And they don't really care whether they gain half a pound or a pound and a half a day.
Very fortunate that you all get to work together. And as you said, it's a full-time job, but not everybody has to be full-timing it when there are lots of folks there. So it's great. All right.
Right. Now, you're getting pickup from my family now who's having a party in the other room. So let me just close some doors so we can hear each other better.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks.
Of course, you're getting the authentic family experience. Pretty soon you'll hear us all swearing at each other.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Hold on.
You must be doing something right if you're partying at 11 a.m. on a weekday.
Well, it's just that everyone's together and it's raining out. What else are you going to do?
Oh, that's the first best advice here for the interview this morning. Shannon, after growing up on a farm and earning a PhD degree in sustainable agriculture and community development, what was the biggest disconnect you experienced between being in academia and actually being on the farm?
There were two disconnects, Robin, that I would go into with you. The first one is I started recognizing in academia that it wasn't a great future for a woman. There was a moment when I was in the bullpen at grad school in my final year working on my dissertation. And, you know, the bullpen is where all the grad students have their little cubicles all right next to each other. So you hear everybody's conversations. And a couple female grad students had congregated in the area of my desk. So I was hearing their conversation, pretending I wasn't listening, of course. And they were talking about another faculty member. And this faculty member was recently divorced. She was single parenting two children under the age of four, and she had transferred into the department from another university, and she was up for her tenure review. And I heard grad students, these are women my age at that time, so we were all in our 20s, and they were talking about how she just wasn't pulling her weight, and she wasn't going to make tenure, and the department couldn't count on her. Grad students, they repeat what they hear from the professors. We're apprentices in this culture. And what they were saying was very alarming to me. I was recently married, and I had chosen academia. One, I loved to research and write. And two, I felt that it would be very conducive to the life that I wanted, which was having a farm and teaching and researching. So I took out a piece of scrap paper and I wrote the basic things that I wanted in my life across the top. And that was to be married, to stay married, to have tenure, and to have children. And I made a list of every single female faculty member that I'd ever had in a 10-year higher education career. And I made checks next to each one to see who scored perfectly in all those categories. Not one woman professor had achieved all of those things. That was the first piece of writing on the wall that my chosen career was going to be problematic. And then the other thing that happened was I was very passionate about my research. I was looking at the sustainability of rural communities. I was looking at the role that farms had in protecting the soil and building communities and creating community welfare. And I realized that everything I was studying was pointing to the fact that I should go home and practice my research. If I could go on in academia, all I was ever going to do was talk about it. And I really wanted to live these changes and make these changes happen in my world and make them so realistic and doable that other people could do it as well. So my life is my research is my life is my research. And I chose a path where I felt like I could have family and I could do my research and I could build a business that really contributed to restoring my community and creating a valuable lifestyle that my children would value.
Absolutely, yes. And just a quick question about that little survey you did. Did you ever look at the male instructors and see how many of those checks
achieved the same?
Yes.
No, I wasn't in that category, and I was in it for myself at that point. That's a good question, though. No one's ever asked me that. I'd be very curious to read that. But
yeah.
I really did start to recognize that academia, I felt at that time, and this was at the turn of the century,
right,
that it was a hostile environment for a woman.
Well, thank you for pursuing and continuing. And now there are many, or in your case, perhaps only a few shoulders to stand on, but there are always more and more coming down the pike,
yep,
so to speak. Yeah. Now, were there specific things your dad, Jim, was implementing on your farm that either didn't get addressed in academia or that you were able to look at and go, oh, yeah, this totally fits?
Yes. Dad was grazing on the farm. And the world of grass-fed was only just starting to crack open when I was in grad school. And we had been doing it for a very long time because Dad had long ago decided this grain feeding thing was not practicable. And so it was becoming trendy. It was becoming ecologically responsible. And Dad had always gone at it and Mom together from an intuitive standpoint.
Right.
You can put any term you want on any of this stuff. You can call it regenerative. You can call it organic. You can call it sustainable. You can call it more healthy, ecological, whatever. But my parents were seat of the pants pragmatics, and that's where it was functioning from. The other thing that I was discovering in grad school was the social significance of small farms. I came in from growing up on my family's small farm, but I also was very, very inculcated in old small farm pre-industrial culture because my parents had this farm up here in West Fulton, and this community is at the northern foothills of the Appalachian Mountain chain. The Appalachian Mountain culture was still very much alive, and farming in this area was considered non-viable because it couldn't industrialize post-World War II. The fields were too rocky. There was too much frost. Everything was, you know, on a steep hillside. So this area couldn't industrialize. So you had people who were subsistence farmers here who were not part of the mainstream ag paradigm at all. So my parents, they had their jobs down in the valley, and they were sending me to school down in the valley, which was a career track kind of school. But my social life was with these farmers up here. These were elderly people who had always lived on just a few thousand dollars a year. I grew up in this system, very much a part of their culture, where I learned that the system of neighbors helping neighbors, and learned in grad school about how the industrialization had torn apart neighbor relationships. I learned about the importance of being able to grow and cook my own food. I had learned that this is how you hold a family together. This is how you make the economy of a farm work. I learned that you run a farm from the kitchen. You don't run a farm from the barn. And I knew about canning and preserving and gardening and cooking with what you had on hand, with what was grown within the seasons. These were all just very intuitive things for me. So I get to grad school and, you know, people are feeling like they're blowing academia out of the water with these landmark ideas about. I came at my graduate education. It was a study of my own childhood and what was important about it. And so completing a PhD, seeing how women were treated in academia, but also recognizing just how valuable the culture was that I came from was, and how going into academia, I risked sacrificing that. I inherited a legacy that has been lost from many people's families and communities. And I recognized with that graduate education the significance of that and the significance of restoring that culture. And I didn't have to learn it all fresh. It was with me. And so to carry memories and to carry history and to bring it forward was a much more important contribution to the development of the field of regenerative agriculture than leaving and teaching about it someplace. You know, my children understand these things from the tips of their toes, out their fingers, and into their minds. They embody this. And that's how you restore culture to an agricultural community. You embody it. And I had a very unique opportunity to continue living a culture that was dying, and I'm a bridge to a new world.
Yes. And in reading about your PhD degree, I don't know if it was one, sustainable agriculture and community development, or if it was two, but they are definitely the same thing, right? Moving from a micro environment to the macro.
Yes. And it was both. And I was interested in those two fields and made the case to my committee that yes, they are two things that need to be done together.
Bravo.
And I developed and did that whole program for myself because that's what I felt I needed to learn.
Shannon, your most recent book, Redefining Rich, has just been published, but I'd like to step back and discuss the community and economy that can take place in the home, which you write about in Radical Homemakers, and I see it as really a deeper dive into feminism, whereas we're moving, as you said, back into the totality of the home and the homemaker, as opposed to, oh, the woman's just at home and the guy's out at work or whatever, and the jobs are totally delineated. But I've never seen that job delineation as a bad thing. It's a more cohesive thing in a lot of ways. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and your experience of that.
Sure. So you're talking about Radical Homemakers a little bit more specifically. And the first thing I want to discuss about that is you remark about the guys having the jobs. And in Radical Homemakers, I actually go back into that history and looked at when did this become a thing where the men left and the women were home? Because originally, it was men and women together running a home, and husband came from houseman, house bonded. So it was the start of the middle class after the Dark Ages in Europe, when people could start to own their own property, and a man and a woman would own their own property together. And the men had just as many domestic responsibilities. And the women may have sewn fabric, but the men sewed leather, and there was a division of labor, but you know, this was an enterprise run by two people. It was with the Industrial Revolution that we started seeing this change, where men went out and women stayed home. It can very well be subjugation, but I saw a lot of homes where one partner was at home, and I saw almost as many men being the stay-at-home person as women, where it was what I call in Redefining Rich, non-monetary income. And it's a significant economic factor in empowering a family domestic unit to be free and to follow their conscience and to not be at the mercy of corporations and the workplace. In my own family, non-monetary income is our single largest source of income. It's huge. I can count the number of years that our household income has exceeded $20,000 on probably my right hand. At the same time, I calculated that non-monetary income. I sat down and put numbers on everything, you know, whether it's providing education for someone at home who needs it, bartering for services, cooking, growing our own food, repairing things. We've crunched the numbers and put it at about $70,000 a year. Now, running a farm, that's easy to do. That's part of how you make a small farm economy work, is you do a lot of that quote-unquote radical homemaking. That non-monetary income is key. But in our family in particular, yes, it is astronomical how much we are able to do. And when you have that kind of self-reliance, you are economically free to obey your conscience, to tie yourself to family and community rather than to a professional career track. So if feminism is about independence, if it's about being able to honor the spirit, honor creativity, and have balance of power, I have seen where it can be a case of subjugation, but I see a lot of people subjugated by their workplace. So if it's being free of subjugation, period, then yeah, we cannot overlook the power of the non-monetary income, the domestic life, in enabling that.
What would you like to say, Shannon, right now about the specifics of running a regenerative farm? What would be a big tip other than what we've been speaking about already?
Well, the one thing that a lot of people forget in regenerative ag is regenerative means it can keep going. It can keep going. And I've been looking at that my whole life, recognizing that I needed to take over from my parents and then someone needs to take over from me. And one of the things that I always struggled with in that was that I am not my father. I don't have his expertise and I do not have his proclivities. And that's often a struggle with farm transitions, that we cannot be our forebears. We are different people, and the times change and ask different things of us. One of the things I have recognized with this process, that I'm a third generation farmer, my daughters are fourth generation, is that we need to honor who each generation is and allow the things to move and adapt with whoever the next generation is. It doesn't always have to be the same way. The change is constant. I don't have my father's skills, but it turned out that in this day and age, we needed a different set of skills, and they happened to be the ones that I was able to bring to the business.
Bravo, yes.
You know, my daughters are strong, beautiful powerhouses, and my father didn't get any grandsons. So they're operating the equipment, and they're working in the meat room and feeding the livestock. At the same time, these girls are in love with fashion, and you just never know what direction anybody's going to take. And they love looking good on the farm. It's just how wild it can look from generation to generation. For me, my role on the farm became somebody who's good at crunching numbers and who has a voice to speak and do the storytelling to help knit the community back together. And my power was in the kitchen. My dad's was in understanding the grazing and in understanding the livestock. It's fascinating to see how each generation brings something very, very different. And I would say you just can never, ever dismiss any of it. It is all relevant. Regenerative ag needs to look at all different aspects of being families on the land and connected to place.
Beautiful. You've written a book on cooking grass-finished beef, so I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite steak? And then, is there a difference, do you find, when you're cooking grass-fed beef and if it's not grass-fed? Does that make a difference?
That makes a huge difference. So I wrote The Grass-Fed Gourmet, and then after The Grass-Fed Gourmet, I did another book just on grilling grass-fed meats called The Farmer and the Grill. And I remember getting hired to go down to a very posh setting in the Mid-Atlantic area and teach a workshop. There was a special chef farm-to-table dinner, and then the next night I did a three-hour grilling workshop. And they were very proud. They were bringing in this very expensive grass-fed meat, and people had paid a lot of money for these tickets. And I got to the grilling demo, and I was getting things set up, and I had to pull the coordinators aside and say, hey, where's my meat? And they showed it to me. And I said, is that what you served me last night? Is it from the same farm? And they said, yes. I said, it's not grass-fed. And I'm sure I got labeled as a brat. But I said, I'm about to teach principles, and what you've got, I can tell you right now, it's grain finished. And they wanted to know what I could taste. I could taste, particularly with the beef, like a mealiness. It was actual lack of flavor. If it's grass fed, you get the sweet herbaceousness that comes through, and you get a mineral rich density, and you get texture in the meat. It's not chewy. I've run tenderness tests on grain-fed, and I've run on grass-fed, dry-aged grass-fed, and the grass-fed actually came out more tender and got better scores. But there is a distinct mouthfeel where the muscle fibers are flaccid. There's no muscle structure, and I can taste that. I can feel that in my mouth, and it's an icky feeling. It would be sort of like biting into a tofu burger rather than a real burger. It's just like, whoa, what is that texture? That's just way too weird. So these are all things that I definitely detect. And that said, I do like to masticate my food, and so my favorite steak is a chuck eye steak. And that's where you have the ribeye muscle that's in the rib primal, which is a pretty pricey steak. And that muscle actually extends up into the chuck primal. And my favorite steak is cut from that primal for a couple of reasons. One, when muscle is moving around in the chuck primal, that's where the animal does a lot of movement, so it's very high flavor. And also, then you have that ribeye going up there, so compared to the rest of the chuck, it's actually quite tender, but it's not as tender as a piece of filet mignon, which is just way too tender for my liking anyhow. So it's a piece that I can rip into, I can let the juices run down my chin, and it's high flavor, and it's very, very well marbled. So there you have my favorite cut.
The Regenerative Conversations with Mike Hands, Jim Hayes, and Shannon Hayes. We're at cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are on the usual platforms. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for making Here Where We Want to Be.